Okay, what I'm going to do is to give you a part of what is developing as a somewhat longer piece of work, and the slides are sort of all here, so I'm going to have to just selectively talk about just a few of these slides and sort of zip through it, and forgive me for that, but I think that the slides are available to you through the APHA. For this meeting, so if you want to look at some of the ones I go over very quickly, you'll be able to do that later. I have no relationships to disclose. What I want to the whole thing sort of falls into four parts. Let me just give you a quick overview, and then we'll jump to the relevant thing for the next few minutes. The first part sort of looks at end of life care from a kind of epidemiological point of view. How do we do as an end-of-life care system in the United States? And I think that to one degree or another, these observations about the United States may also hold for many of the developing countries of the world. And then I want to talk about the sort of response about end-of-life care decision-making that we have had over the last 30 years in the United States, and contrast what I refer to as an individual empowerment approach to improving end-of-life care through improving end-of-life decision-making and making it more patient-centered and more patient-empowered versus what I regard as a more systemic approach to attempting to improve end-of-life, the quality of living while dying, and the quality of end-of-life care, which is represented by hospice and palliative care as models of end-of-life care. And having made that contrast, I then want to, in the third part, talk a bit about the difficulties that we have encountered as we have, in fact, implemented large portions of the individual empowerment approach to improving end-of-life care decision-making, and yet it has been difficult to actually improve the quality of outcomes and the quality of the experience of dying, even though we have passed many laws and made many changes in our health, in our acute healthcare system, in the direction of that patient-centered empowerment strategy, which has not really been a systemic strategy as much as it has been a kind of micro decision-making strategy. It's very complicated and very difficult to live that strategy in one's own care and in one's own end-of-life experience. Having noted the problems with that approach, my thesis, my hypothesis is that a systemic approach would, in fact, be more likely to enhance the quality of living while dying in the United States, but that the hospice and palliative care model per se, if taken in isolation, and as I think Nancy mentioned a number of times, if taken as sort of embedded in clinical settings, particularly hospital medical center settings, which are not entirely institutionally and culturally conducive to this model. It's a kind of an add-on. It's hived off in certain ways. Taken in isolation, these systemic models of palliative care and hospice won't do the trick. What they have to do is be embedded in a community support structure of civil society in which there can be actually good interaction between the palliative care model approach, which I'll characterize briefly in a moment, and the broader community support systems that exist to enhance the quality of care received and the support and understanding people have about the end-of-life care process. So, having made that kind of trajectory in my argument, What I really propose here is both a practical kind of argument and an ethical kind of argument or normative kind of argument. I want to say that by looking at community capacity and systemic capacity in a public health approach, I think as Tim put it, a public health philosophical framework, we can better see how to improve end-of-life care and ameliorate some of the problems that we've had with the individual micromanagement in the United States. That's the sort of practical aspect of the argument. The normative aspect of the argument is that not only will a public health perspective on end-of-life care give us a better mechanisms for supporting patients and families and caregivers, medical professionals, in this enterprise, but it will also reestablish a normative foundation, which I'm calling a civic practice or community-based perspective, and that I would embrace Nancy's concept of solidarity as a way of expressing the normative view that I think is necessary for end-of-life care improvement, but which comes more readily out of a public health perspective than it does out of the perspectives that we have been using heretofore in our approaches to improving end-of-life care. So that, in broad strokes, is the argument I'm trying to make. Let me just touch very briefly on some of these slides. We have, from an epidemiological point of view, a whole profile of end-of-life care in the United States, which is not good. We violate individual rights in the sense that we do not really adhere to advanced directives even when they are available. Oftentimes, we do not give adequate pain and suffering symptom management control. We have arguably an expensive and dehumanizing overuse of high technology, and there's a tremendous family burden of caregiving, unpaid caregiving associated with end-of-life care, and financial burdens, not only for families but for the whole system, associated with the care during the last year, the last 6 months of life in our healthcare system. All of these things ought to be waving, in my view, red flags from a public health perspective, because these are the components of the way in which we identify practically and empirically public health problems. So that's not a good profile. Of course, how we die, as Nancy points out, has shifted over into a chronic sort of degenerative illness mode from during the 20th century. There's an article entitled this a few years ago, "The Chronically Terminally Ill," or something like that. Terminal illness has become chronic. 90% of Americans roughly die from such underlying illness courses. There's very high burden associated with these illnesses and with the dying process. I'm going to skip over these conceptual models that Joanne Lynn has developed. This one, I'll say, there's a little slice of people that we're focusing on in particular here, and she broke it down into three sort of illness trajectories. In light of Nancy's analysis, I think we need to change the slope, perhaps, of the top cancer representation. This is not data-based graphs, by the way. These are conceptual graphs, but nevertheless, I think we'd have to say that the top graph for cancer is more of a downward slope, perhaps, than that suggests. And people are not telling us that they are having good experience. Family members after death, they're not telling us that they have good experiences with the care that their loved one has received in terms of the impact on that person or the impact on the family. So from a public health standpoint, we have not only inadequate quality, but we have inadequate system properties, very fragmented lack of continuity of care and care coordination and communication, as well as disparities in the way in which the present system works for persons and their families who are dying. Then we have this sort of second part in which I'm talking about the approach that we've taken since roughly the 1970s with the Quinlan case. And I want to distinguish here the individualistic or empowerment approach, as I mentioned, and what I would refer to as a relational or more systemic kind of approach to end-of-life care. These things, interestingly enough, historically, develop roughly in parallel over the same period of time, from roughly the early 1970s, first hospice program in the United States, 1973, Karen N. Quinlan case, 1975, 76. And so we have both of them going on. It's not as if we started with the sort of individual empowerment stuff and then the palliative care hospice stuff came later. They were both there. But as far as I can see, there was little communication between or among these two approaches at the early stage. Increasingly, they've become intertwined as we go into this 30-year-plus period. And indeed, what I'm going to argue in a minute is that even the people who have been at work in the individualistic empowerment paradigm have come now to shift their own emphasis toward a more relational approach, if only because they recognize that the overly atavistic and individualistic approach of the statutes and practices and policies that promote patient-centered empowerment in end-of-life decision-making are often self-defeating because of their excessive fragmentation and individualism. That is to say, people are empowered as agents or surrogates for patients who have lost capacity, but they don't actually function the way the paradigm wants them to function because they are in a family context, and their family relationships override or overwhelm their sort of patient-centered standards and ideals, as one might expect humanly, sociologically, psychologically, that they would. So the need for better communication, the need for recognizing social interaction, at least within the family system, at least within the clinical institutional system. Sharon Kaufman has written a recent book called And a Time to Die, which is a wonderful ethnographic study of how a hospital system is the context within which end-of-life care decision-making gets embedded and the effects of that embeddedness. More and more, this is being recognized as important to even the patient empowerment paradigm and project in the United States. So I'll jump ahead. Here's a bunch of, I didn't take that off, sorry. Isn't that fun? Look at that. A number of different definitions of palliative care, which I'll spare you. Basically, an overview of this sort of relational palliative care model. It emphasizes continuity, chronicity. It emphasizes communication, shared decision-making, advanced planning, symptom control, and holistic care, psychosocial and spiritual needs, and provides practical support for individuals, often in their home. Now, some of the problems are in this second part, which I'm going to skip over, but I think that my notion is that what I'm going to turn to now, community-oriented approach or civic practice, can perhaps help to ameliorate some of the problems of this end-of-life reform movement that we've had for the last 30 years in terms of trying to get away from the overly rationalistic and individualistic nature of the framework, perhaps get away from some of the ethical controversy about social and ethical bias within the framework, and try to give us a more systemic population approach. So I come to the last part here, which is what I'm calling, quote-unquote, healthy dying as a civic practice. And I believe, as I said, that there is a growing trend in the recognition that we need to move toward a more relational understanding, a more ecological conception, as Mary Beth has outlined and developed very much in her work, to a more holistic approach, which is already embodied in hospice and palliative care orientations, of course, but arguably needs also to be set out in a larger context of local communities. So we want to provide care, we want to deal with the overall condition of the patient in their cultural and social context, we want continuity, and we want to get a sense of community and meaning or culture in our end-of-life care experience. And to do that, we could turn, I think, to building or maintaining a community matrix to support the quality of living while dying, and maintain a background for the kind of individual information, support, understanding that can come not only out of the internal relationships within families and the relationships with professional healthcare professionals and caregivers, but also from the civil society more broadly, from churches, from civic organizations, from support groups, from neighbors, from block-based support systems, from local government, from the local media. All of these things can be mobilized toward the concept of this community is a place where people can die well. This is a community of caring and solidarity and relationality where we are, in fact, and here we switch over to my so-called normative argument, where we are, in fact, as John Donne said, parts of the main, not islands, and everybody's poor dying, everybody's unhealthy dying diminishes me because I am a part of a community. I am a part of a moral landscape. And this has been attempted in the so-called Missoula Demonstration Project, which I'm looking into and making a kind of a case study of. I've also looked at some large and very innovative hospice programs which have reached out to build community capacity also, and have done something quite similar to what they were attempting to do with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation support in Missoula, Montana in the late 1990s. And it's a very interesting case study, I think. And it basically leads us then to the kinds of conclusions that I want to suggest. And here is a question of public health ethics for me. To me, there is a difference between looking at something from the point of view of a population, which is understood to be simply a large number of individuals, versus looking at something from the point of view of a community or a civitas, which is a structure of moral caring and commitment, not simply an aggregation of individual rights, needs, and interests. So that's an important conceptual distinction, I believe, to orient our thinking about what public health programs really are all about and what they should try to achieve. And let me then end with a final contrast between a kind of a consumer model and a kind of civic or citizenship model. End-of-life care, I think, should be conceptualized, and I'd like to try to make a persuasive argument of an ethical kind for this conclusion, that end-of-life care should be conceptualized on the right-hand side of this comparison, rather than on the left. All too often today in our individual empowerment model, it is seen as a consumer rights, in consumer empowerment issue. I don't have anything against rights, and I don't have anything against empowerment, although in America, at least, if not more broadly in the world, rights is often understood as very conflict-based and individualistic. I don't have anything against rights and anything against empowerment. But I do have something against the notion that end-of-life care is primarily about hiving us off and separating us from others rather than ending our lives in the context of relationships and webs of meaning and care. And I don't think we in public health want to make that mistake, and I think we can, in fact, be voices to correct that emphasis, which is all too prevalent in American culture generally, and public health can be a countervailing voice to that, and it should be, I think.